Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We begin with the bombshell dropped on Wall Street today in the form of an op-ed in the New York Times by a former Goldman Sachs executive who wrote, "Why I am leaving Goldman Sachs," accusing the company of being morally bankrupt with a working environment now as toxic and destructive as ever. William Cohen, a contributing editor to Fortune and author of Money and Power, How Goldman Sachs Came to Rule the World, joins us. Then we'll examine how super PACs are determining who will run for the presidency in this election and likely who will be the next president. Ari Berman, a contributing writer to The Nation and an investigative journalism fellow at The Nation Institute, joins us to discuss the overwhelming influence of super PACs on our already money-driven electoral system and how a handful of billionaires will determine the political fate of the nation. Then finally, British humorist Martin Lewis joins us to take a wry look at the current visit of UK Prime Minister David Cameron to the White House at a convenient time for Cameron when back home his friend and neighbour Rebecca Brooks, the former head of Rupert Murdoch's British media empire, is being arrested along with five others for conspiring to pervert the course of justice. And again, I'd like to invite you to join me tomorrow night, Thursday, March the 15th at 7 p.m. for UCLA Hammer Forum. I'm moderating Buying Votes with Lawrence Lessig, the director of the Center for Ethics at Harvard University and author of Republic Lost, How Money Corrupts Congress and a Plan to Stop It. Again, tomorrow night, March the 15th, 7 p.m., free and open to the public. Join me at the UCLA Hammer Forum. Joining us now is William Cohen, a contributing editor at Fortune and a writer for Vanity Fair and the New York Times, who covers a variety of financial issues. He began his career as an investigative reporter in Raleigh, North Carolina, and then went on to work on Wall Street for over a decade and a half, both at Lazare Fred and J.P. Morgan Chase. He's the author of House of Cards, A Tale of Hubris and Wretched Excess on Wall Street, The Last Tycoons, The Secret History of Lazare Fred and Company, and his latest book, Money and Power, How Goldman Sachs Came to Rule the World. Welcome to Background Briefing, William Cohen.
Thank you, Ian. Nice to be here.
And Goldman Sachs, your latest book, Money and Power, How Goldman Sachs Came to Rule the World, they sure got a black eye today from the head of their branch in London, Greg Smith, has an op-ed in today's New York Times. You're there on Wall Street, Bill. I bet you there's quite a lot of people that read that op-ed.
There's no bigger story in Manhattan today than this op-ed in the New York Times about Greg Smith's op-ed about Goldman Sachs. There's no question about that.
And what kind of impact do you think it'll have? You know, it really gets to the heart of what he says is wrong. He said that it may be a surprise to people, but there is such a thing as a culture in both on Wall Street and in a company. And now he's saying that I can honestly say that the environment at Goldman Sachs is as toxic and destructive as I've ever seen it.
Well, look, as you and I have talked about before, Goldman Sachs has been in and out of trouble its whole existence. There are numerous instances that I recount in the book of how it's put its interests before its clients. So I don't know why particularly Greg Smith is just waking up to this today. I mean, this has been an ongoing problem at Goldman Sachs. I'm sure there's a lot of teeth gnashing down at the firm today because I think, frankly, after a period of extremely bad publicity from, you know, the beginning of 2009 through much of 2011, I think, you know, they were sort of hoping to have put this behind them. And unfortunately, this raises the whole specter of the vampire squid again in a way that is, you know, completely not flattering for the firm. But as far as the content of what he wrote about, that has been something that has been on the minds of people for a long time, both inside and outside the firm. And as you know, you'll remember from Senator Levin's hearing in April 2010, this is very much what Senator Levin was talking about for 11 hours on that spring day. So, again, while, I mean, the worst part of this from Goldman's perspective is this is something they thought they had put behind them in the last year.
Well, Greg Smith, he apparently advised two of the largest hedge funds on the planet, five of the largest asset managers in the U.S., and three of the most prominent sovereign wealth funds. And his clients had a total asset base of more than $1 trillion. It sounds like he could go into business on his own.
I'm not sure what he can do, Ian. I don't think he can work on Wall Street anymore. This is the kind of, you know, while it's very raw and honest, and many people appreciate his honesty. This is the kind of thing that they hate on Wall Street, and clients hate this too because, you know, they expect their bankers or their traders or whoever it is they're working with to be able to keep their confidence and not, you know, go blabbing to the press about what happens or things that they don't like about what happens. And clearly that's not the case here. And unless he's got some really special skills that none of us know about. I mean, the truth of the matter is that people think they do a really good job and are really good at their job when they've got a Goldman Sachs jersey on. They take that jersey off, and unless they're an incredibly talented hedge fund manager or derivatives trader or whatever it is, he might find that he has a very, very difficult time getting a new job. And, you know, clients and employers don't like when their employees, tell air the dirty linen of Wall Street on the op-ed page of the New York Times. That's why this is causing a storm, because it's such a rare occurrence. And it's never happened, as far as I can tell, in the history of Goldman Sachs. And so this is not something that's going to make him very popular. I mean, if he's got a rare skill and a rare talent, then he's going to be fine. But I suspect he doesn't. He's just a vice president, a mid-level employee who lost his job, and I'm sure he's not happy about it. And out of frustration, he wrote this article. And it's very interesting to read, and it's refreshing to read, and it needed probably to be written. But it's not going to mean he's going to be – nobody's going to really hurry to hire this guy, in my estimation.
Well, did he lose his job, or did he quit?
Well, you know, there's a fine line. Honestly, Ian, nobody quits their job on Wall Street in his position. Look, I don't know the guy and I don't know the details, but it would be a rare person indeed who quit his job in March of a new year. I'm sure there's more to it than I know about, but, either he didn't get a good bonus that he liked or he wasn't happy in his job. He may have quit or he may have been told, you might as well start looking around. Obviously, he didn't sign any of the documents that usually they have to sign to tie these people up in knots so they don't do things like this. So there's obviously more to the story than we know, and we don't know whether he quit or whether he, was fired.
Again, I'm speaking with William Cohen, contributing editor at Fortune and a writer for Vanity Fair and the New York Times. He's the author of Money and Power, How Goldman Sachs Came to Rule the World. Well, the message, though, that Goldman Sachs, and we've heard this before, as you mentioned in Senate 11's hearings, with the this, I can't repeat the word that he kept repeating so often,
right.
That they gave their clients such blank deals. That's his message is basically the same, that they care more right. about making money off their clients than they making money for their clients.
That's unfortunately that's the reality of life at Goldman Sachs, and that's the way it's been. I could give you examples going back to the Depression. I could give you examples to 1970. I could give you examples to 2006 and 1993 and 1994. I can give you a lot of examples, Ian. This has been going on a long time at Goldman Sachs. One would have thought there would have been some reform after this financial crisis. But if you read, say, Judge Leo Strine's incredible opinion from February 29th, where he talks about this El Paso Kinder Morgan deal, you'll see that's filled with Goldman's bad behavior. And once again, you see Greg Smith talking about it. So, this is something that got a lot of attention today, but this has been going on for a long time. Senator Levin's been talking about it. The SEC's been talking about it. This is a real problem for Goldman Sachs, and unless they fix this, they're not going to be in business very long because, they don't have anything but their reputation. And if they keep messing up their reputation, clients aren't going to want to do business with them.
Well, you'd think they would have got the message last time, and if they don't get the message from Greg Smith's op-ed, you wonder why they put their money, give their money away to these people whose priority is to make money for themselves, not for their clients, it would seem. But there's also this you mentioned that you can't rock the boat. Lloyd Blankfein and all of these guys are kind of the princes of Wall Street. Look what happened with MF Global. What, $1.5 billion is still missing, and the guy's not going to go to jail. And I mean, it's amazing.
Ian. I mean, this is a long-term problem. I mean, nobody's been held accountable for what's happened on Wall Street. You and I have discussed this before. It's despicable. It continues to be unconscionable that no one's been held accountable for this. If you're a client of Goldman Sachs, this is not a good day. If you're Goldman Sachs, this is not a good day. But the truth is, Bear Stearns is gone, Lehman Brothers gone, Merrill Lynch is not what it was. Morgan Stanley is not what it was. There are very few options for clients these days if you want to do the kind of business that you can do with Goldman Sachs. And so, you know, they have very few choices at this point in time. And so until that, new firms come along who are willing to do the kinds of things that Goldman will do for their clients, then clients are not going to have much choice, and they're going to have to put up with this. And that's what you're seeing right now. I mean, I had a lot of people who talked to me, in the writing of this book, clients who told me many of these same things that Greg Smith wrote about. They did it anonymously because they're so afraid of Goldman Sachs and not being able to do business with them anymore. But they wanted people to know that this is going on, and it's not a good thing. And, you know, until Goldman Sachs solves this, then they're going to have a lot of angry clients on their hands, and frankly, a lot of, you know, frustrated employees who think they're working hard and doing a good job, and then this is the kind of public image that people have of them, and it's not anything to be desired.
Well, what do you think is going on Wall Street in general? William Cohen, again, the author of Money and Power, How Goldman Sachs Came to Rule the World. Mitt Romney, who lost two primaries last night in Mississippi and Alabama, was on Wall Street at a big fundraiser. The Obama campaign is now saying that the Koch brothers and others are going to be running hundreds of millions of dollars super PACs against them, and that they're concerned that there's not a level playing field even for Obama, who's proven to be a great fundraiser, and the money's apparently not coming in like it is for the Republicans. Is Wall Street pivoting to Romney?
Oh, I think Wall Street has been firmly in Romney's camp for a long time. I mean, there are a few sort of diehard Democrats on Wall Street who will continue to support President Obama, but I think that by and large, the majority of people on Wall Street have been fed up with Obama for some time and have been supporting Mitt Romney quite extensively. And I don't really see that changing. And I don't think there's much that Obama can do against that at this point, even though he's had fundraisers on Wall Street. But he is not in a position at the moment to come back to Wall Street and expect to get a lot of money.
Well, given how much Wall Street is driving up the price of gasoline, I spoke to an oil and gas analyst who's considered to be one of the leading experts on this subject, Fidel Guite. I spoke with him yesterday at Oppenheimer & Company, and he said that at least a third of the price of gasoline is due to the gaming on Wall Street, the speculation, which is done through what's called the Goldman Sachs Index. And Goldman Sachs and these big banks are pushing the price up, along with the hedge fund managers and the pension funds whose money it is, that are making these bets, and that this is all about greed. It's about, you know, basically a bunch of people finding a way to make money for themselves at the expense of the rest of us who have to drive the car to work, and some people have to make a choice between food on the table and gas in the tank. It's an outrageous situation. I'm just trying to wonder here whether there's a connection. If Wall Street's gaming the price of oil, the CBS New York Times poll that came out yesterday said that Obama's approval is an all-time low because of the price of gas and the perception that he's not doing anything about it. If Wall Street's backing Romney, and if the best thing that the Republicans have got going for them is the high price of gas, is there a connection there?
So, I mean, I think that it's tempting. I mean, that's an interesting sort of conspiracy theory, but I really don't see how oil traders would be driving up the price of oil and gasoline in order to help get Romney elected, because I just don't see how that's likely to happen, although it's hurting Obama's approval rating. You know, we've got a long time to go before the election, and I just don't think high oil prices alone are going to be the reason. If Obama doesn't get reelected, it's not going to be because of high oil prices, high gas prices.
Well, I guess another way to look at it is the traders are only interested in making money, right?
Right, exactly. I mean, and they'll trade the oil futures when they're up and when they're down, and that's what they care about, making money first and foremost. They care less about whether it's Romney in the White House or Obama in the White House.
But there are certain things that a candidate can promise them, like we will make sure the Commodities and Futures Trading Commission do absolutely nothing. We will gut Dodd-Frank and neuter the new Consumer Financial Protection Agency, et cetera, et cetera.
Yes, and clearly Romney has promised that, and they're very happy about that. That's probably why they support him. But, you know, candidates say a lot of things when they're trying to get elected, and then, you know, once they're in the White House, you know, we see what, I mean, Obama was going to be the candidate of change, remember? I mean, you know, change that we can believe in. And he got to the White House and, you know, more things stayed the same than they then have changed. And, you know, the reality, presidents are confronted with realities all the time once they get off the campaign trail. So, I mean, I think Romney's in a position now where he'll say anything to get elected. And he's obviously got the support of Wall Street, but I don't think, you know, high gas prices alone and traders aren't driving up the price of gas, the oil and oil, because they want to see Romney elected. I mean, we've got a lot of things going on here with, you know, Iran and demand and, you know, speculation that are driving the price of oil higher, not because they want Romney to be elected.
Well, no, I think you've definitely shot down my conspiracy theory, Will. But I still think, though, that the fact that the press is not talking about it very much and that they're coming up with all kinds of ridiculous excuses for the price of gas and that the politicians aren't speaking up about it, except for Bernie Sanders, not a peep out of any of them, I think you can make the case that there's nothing more powerful than the Wall Street banking lobby, and there's probably no lobby that has a great attraction on Capitol Hill than the Wall Street banking lobby, right?
I think you'd be, I mean, except for maybe the healthcare lobby, I think you're probably absolutely right. I mean, Wall Street has been working its magic in Washington for generations, and it continues to on both sides of the aisle. I mean, I'm sure Goldman Sachs is one of the biggest donors to Mitt Romney. I'm sure they're one of the biggest donors to President Obama. I mean, they hedge their bets, you know, in their own portfolio as they do, you know, in Washington. And so I think, you know, they're going to continue to get their pound of flesh out of Washington, and it's not going to really cost them all that much money to do so.
Well, all you have to do is mention Hank Paulson, Robert Rubin, John Corzine.
You know, Bob Zoellick, head of the World Bank. I mean, you can go on and on and on.
Right.
Mario Draghi, Mario Monti.
And so it goes. Well, Bill, I thank you so much for joining us here today to fill us in on this, the scandal of the day on Wall Street and in Manhattan. And you're pretty much suggesting it's going to be pretty ephemeral and they'll be back to business in the blink of an eye.
Unfortunately, I think you're absolutely right, Ian.
Well, I thank you again for joining us.
My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with William Cohan, contributing editor at Fortune and a writer for Vanity Fair, The New York Times. He covers a variety of financial issues and began his career as an investigative reporter in Raleigh, North Carolina, and went on to work on Wall Street for over a decade and a half, both at Lazare Frere and J.P. Morgan Chase. He's the author of House of Cards, A Tale of Hubris and Wretched Excess on Wall Street, The Last Tycoons, The Secret History of Lazare Frere and Company, and his latest book, Money and Power, How Goldman Sachs Came to Rule the World. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about the extraordinary influence of super PACs over this election.
It's time to get away. It's time to get away from you. It's time to get away. It's time to get away from you. You bought a lot of money.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Ari Berman, a contributing writer to The Nation magazine and an investigative journalism fellow at The Nation Institute. He has written extensively about American politics, foreign policy, and the intersection of money and politics. He's the author of Herding Donkeys, The Fight to Rebuild the Democratic Party and Reshape American Politics. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ari Berman.
Thanks for having me back, Ian.
And when we last spoke fairly recently, Ari, you had written the article, The 0.00063% Election, about the super PACs and how few people are involved in determining our political future here in this 2012 election. But now there's a little more information about who these people are, and there's absolutely no question that Gingrich wouldn't be in the race but for his sugar daddy, and I imagine that the same is true for Santorum, in spite of the fact that he's doing so well as a kind of, you know, semi-grassroots candidate.
Yeah, so there was a new analysis from the Huffington Post that found that 59 donors gave $500,000 or more to at least one super PAC, and that accounted for 61% of all contributions to super PACs. So just to summarize, 59 donors gave $500,000 or more, and that accounted for 61% of all contributions to super PACs. And that's an incredibly small number of people wielding an absolutely disproportionate amount of influence, not only over the political process, but just even over the funding of super PAC themselves. And we are seeing that as the primary contests go on, super PAC money is becoming even more important. As you mentioned, Newt Gingrich, particularly after poor finishes in Alabama and Mississippi, he is entirely dependent now on super PAC money. And it was interesting to hear Newt Gingrich talk in his speech in, I forget where he was, but on the night of Alabama and Mississippi, talking about all his small donors, when the reality is that his campaign is funded by one person, Sheldon Adelson, and once Sheldon Adelson decides that he's not writing any more checks to Gingrich, Gingrich's campaign is essentially over. So we now have a situation where one person can essentially bankroll a candidate if they have enough money. Even Rick Santorum, who has been massively outspent by Mitt Romney, he has been able to stay in the game and have enough money to operate because of his own super PAC. And then Romney has this enormous financial advantage, not only because of his campaign, but also because of his super PAC. And they will, for now at least, be able to keep going back to that well and raising more and more money, which is really what makes Romney the prohibitive frontrunner. When everyone says, well, why is Romney still the favorite? It's largely, honestly, because he has the most money, and that's what Republicans really seem to care about as much as electability. And so we are seeing super PACs play a very large role in 2012.
Well, what's interesting, though, about Sheldon Adelson and his wife and daughters who have single-handedly funded Gingrich's campaign is that Gingrich is really the best thing that ever happened to Mitt Romney. There's no question from analyzing what happened last night in Mississippi and Alabama. It's so clear that Gingrich is splitting the conservative anti-Romney vote. And if he wasn't there, this would be clearly a two-man race between Santorum and Romney. Now, Adelson had previously said that if it doesn't work out for Gingrich, he would switch his support to Romney. But in a way, you can make the argument that by supporting Gingrich now, he's doing more for Romney than giving money directly to Romney.
It's true. It is kind of, when you think about it, sort of a Machiavellian argument. Gingrich and Adelson have a long personal relationship, so it did seem like Adelson was going to continue to fund Gingrich for as long as Gingrich needed to be funded for. But now he doesn't necessarily need to pull the plug because, as you mentioned, Gingrich is taking more votes away from Santorum than he is from Romney, and arguably Adelson would have more influence if he keeps funding Gingrich, as you mentioned, than if he would stop doing that and support Romney, and it would become a two-person race between Santorum and Romney. And a lot of polls have shown that if it's just Santorum and Romney in a number of important swing states, such as North Carolina, Santorum would actually beat Romney, whereas now in the three-person race, Santorum is losing to Romney. So that is an interesting point you bring up. I'm not sure if that's quite what's motivating him, but it is clear that not only does Adelson not like Romney, not only does Adelson not want Santorum to be the nominee, but he's also pledged that he will support Romney, so he's going to support him one way or another.
Again, I'm speaking with Ari Berman, contributing writer to The Nation magazine and an investigative journalism fellow at The Nation Institute. He's written extensively about American politics, foreign policy, and the intersection of money and politics, and he's the author of Herding Donkeys, The Fight to Rebuild the Democratic Party and Reshape American Politics. He had an article out recently, the 0.0000063% election. We're talking about the influence of super PACs, how few people are determining this 2012 election. And just to run through some of the names here, you've got hedge fund billionaire Ken Griffin, who told the Chicago Tribune that he thinks the wealthy actually have an insufficient influence in the political system. You've got the biggest one of all, Harold Simmons, the Dallas businessman who funded Swiftboat Veterans for Truth and torpedoed or helped torpedo Kerry. Most of these people are hedge fund people, right? John Paulson, Paul Singer, Bruce Kovner, Julian Robinson, Peter Thiel, Lewis Bacon, and Jane Simmons. Now, not to be conspiratorial again, Ari, but isn't it a bit extraordinary when just yesterday CBS released this poll saying that President Obama's approval ratings have taken the worst hit and they've gone down to their lowest level to 41%, which the poll attributes entirely to the price of gasoline and the expectation on the part of voters that President Obama should be doing something about it. If, as is true, and I've done some homework on this, Ari, spoke yesterday with Fidel Geit, one of the country's leading experts on the oil and gas market. He says that 30% of the oil and gas market is being gamed by Wall Street, and that's it's speculation is responsible for 30% of the price at the pump. We just saw that Romney did a fundraiser last night on Wall Street, and obviously Wall Street's pretty comfortable with him. Can you connect the dots here? You got all these hedge fund guys funding these Republican candidates. At the same time, these hedge fund people are the ones that are driving up the price of gas, and that's twisting Obama in the wind, and it's the best thing that the Republicans have got to run on. What do you think? Am I blowing smoke here?
Well, it's an interesting argument. I mean, you don't know exactly if you get from A to B in terms of the support, but it is true that we've seen a huge shift from Wall Street away from Obama to Romney. If you look at the super PAC numbers, seven of the biggest funders on Wall Street have given Romney $7.35 million already. That money is going to keep flowing towards Romney. Most likely he's outraising Obama 11-1 on Wall Street. And it was funny, I got a notification on my phone, I think yesterday, that the Dow closed at a record high. And yet the president doesn't seem to be getting any credit for that. And I think that not only the gas prices going up, but I also think if you want to think about it in terms of another theory, is that with what's happening with the bluster of Iran is also driving up gas prices here. And so that's kind of a twofer issue for Republicans, in that they have an issue they can attack Obama on being insufficiently hawkish on Iran, and it also has the extension of hurting him domestically at home as well in terms of driving up gas prices. So I do think, particularly with regards to some of the war drums we're hearing on Iran, there is an element of politics in that as well that relates to gas prices.
Well, just to be specific, Ari Berman, the element would be, one, that John McCain and Lindsey Graham were responsible for pushing the National Defense Authorization Act that President Obama said he would veto because it would force up the price of gas by pushing the Iranians to the wall. And then on top of that, we've seen an awful lot of speculation about Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu's intentions to strike with or without American approval. And there's no question that Netanyahu is a lot more comfortable than the Republicans than he is with Obama, right?
Yeah, and no one knows if when Mitt Romney and the other candidates have gone over to Israel and made their pilgrimage to Netanyahu, what was discussed in those meetings. But it's certainly true that Netanyahu is making Obama's life difficult, that Obama would really prefer that Israel not strike Iran, not only for their potential security ramifications in the Middle East, but also for the potential security ramifications in the U.S. as well. And this is an issue that is difficult for the president to deal with in an election year, and Netanyahu certainly isn't helping matters. And really, when Netanyahu comes over here and he makes these sort of statements, it just helps the Republicans. It gives them another issue to hit Obama with, and also it's an attempt to divide the Jewish vote at home as well. And Tom Friedman, who's obviously no radical, the columnist for the New York Times, made the point that in the super PAC era, when candidates are more beholden to big money than ever before, large money from Jewish donors is incredibly important and increasingly important. So there is a connection, I think, between Iran, Netanyahu, and super PACs, just to continue the theme of this conversation. I mean, it does kind of all together. It's come together in some ways in the form of the Israeli lobby.
Well, Ari Berman, again, a contributing writer to The Nation magazine and an investigative journalism fellow at The Nation. We have one of the heads of the campaign, David Plouffe, coming out with great alarm about how the Obama campaign is going to be outspent, and warning about Koch brothers super PAC. So they're not crying wolf, are they?
Well, the Koch brothers have already announced they're going to spend $100 million to defeat Obama. And in fact, the Obama people have said that the Koch brothers might spend $500 million in coordination with other GOP groups. Joe Biden apparently said this week that the Koch brothers and other GOP groups might set $800 million. So you never really know how much of this is politics. But the fact is, we do know that Koch and company are going to spend in excess of $100 million, most likely. And the Obama campaign views that as a major disadvantage for the president going into his reelection campaign. Now, as of late, even since Obama shifted and decided he was going to support his own super PAC, they haven't really raised a lot of money. And not only have they not only raised a lot of money, but the fact is where the money came from, the fact that it was from a $1 million donation from Bill Maher, prompted all these news stories and the false equivalency of saying, well, Rush Limbaugh is to the Republican Party as Bill Maher is to the Democratic Party, which, of course, everyone knows is completely untrue. I mean, one of Bill Maher's biggest issues is legalizing drugs, and there's no way the president is going to do that. So Maher has very little influence over the Democratic Party or the Obama administration. But what he said is he gave that money to try to inspire other wealthy liberals to give, and that hasn't happened yet. In fact, the biggest donors to the Democratic Party in the past few election cycles, people like Peter Lewis and George Soros, they have said publicly they are going to sit this election out. So it's going to be hard for the Obama super PAC to raise the amount of money to compete with the Republicans on this front.
And Bill Maher, if anything, is a pretty scathing critic of Democrats for being feckless and pussies. I think he's he's called them on any number of occasions. There's certainly no equivalence there, Ari Berman. But just inherent in this, though, hardly a subtext, is the hatred of Obama. And when the Koch brothers say that they'll spend whatever it takes to defeat Obama, and what we saw down in the South, in Mississippi and Alabama, apparently almost a totally white evangelical vote that showed up there. The one unifying factor, apparently, is a hatred of Obama. And it feels as if people are being given permission to hate Obama, not just hate him, but pony up money.
Yeah, well, it's a double-edged sword, though, because you mentioned that New York Times poll that showed Obama's approval rating at an all-time low. But that poll, I think, was really an outlier. There's been a number of other polls released recently that showed the president in pretty good position beating Mitt Romney, including a Pew Research poll that came up today that had Obama up 12 on Romney. And what it found is that voters' impressions of the Republican Party is increasingly negative. They view the Republican Party as increasingly extreme. And so this Obama hatred that you're seeing in places like Alabama and Mississippi isn't necessarily helping the Republican Party. And not only that, Obama's big advantages, according to the poll, are among women, among younger voters, and among minorities. And those are the very people that Democrats need to turn out in 2012 that did not turn out in 2010. And so you're seeing some of the rhetoric on the Republican side and some of the Obama hate on the Republican side start to motivate Democrats and start to motivate constituencies that favor the president in large numbers in 2008 that they need to turn out in 2012. And so in some ways, Republicans are helping the president by going so far to the right in this primary.
Do you think it's too intellectual an argument to make to the Democrats that, you know, the obvious, we've heard this before, that the elections have consequences, and it's no more stark than what happened in 2010. In 2008, 140 million showed up and voted, swept Obama and the Democrats in. They got the trifecta. 2 years later, they got blown away with about 75 million people voting, most of whom were Republicans. The lesson is that elections have consequences in the sense that these Republican governors and legislatures have been passing all kinds of laws, very, very activist social agenda, which is alarming a lot of the women in the country. But inherent in what they're doing or is this election suppression that's manifest across the country from, you know, Wisconsin to a lot of the southern states. Now, the Attorney General has finally stepped up and held up the Texas law, and the state judges have held up the Wisconsin law. Where do you think that stands? Because the naked voter suppression motives on the part of the Republicans should shame them equally. It should motivate Democrats to be outraged.
Yeah, so I've written a lot about this issue. I covered it for a story in Rolling Stone called The GOP War on Voting, and I've been writing about it more recently as well. And there have been some positive developments with regards to the Department of Justice blocking new voter ID laws in Texas and South Carolina that discriminate disproportionately against minority voters, and also blocking restrictions to voter registration drives and to early voting in Florida. So that has been good, although those states are still seeking a judgment from the D.C. District Court. And so the D.C. District Court could decide to break with the Justice Department on this issue and pre-clear the laws in those three states. Elsewhere, though, as you mentioned, the law has been blocked for now in Wisconsin. They had a very strict voter ID law. There will be a referendum in Ohio on that state's cutbacks in early voting. There are some other legal challenges working their way through the system. But at the same time, the state of Pennsylvania just passed a voter ID law. They're the first state to do so in 2012, and they will be the ninth GOP state to pass a voter ID law since 2010. And Republicans have changed election laws in more than a dozen states, and we don't know how many of them were hauled up, but it's a good bet that almost all of the laws, or most of them, will go through. And so we are facing a different environment now, and it's another issue that Democrats and progressive groups have to prepare for. It's not just enough to get people to the polls, that you have to get them to the polls with the right ID. And when you're talking about some Democratic constituencies, younger voters, some minority voters, some elderly voters, they are less likely to have those IDs than members of the public at large. And so it's a big problem for Democrats in 2012. It's no coincidence that Republicans passed these laws after taking power in response to the Obama election. If there is a large turnout, if there is, in fact, as we're seeing based on the polls, a large young turnout, a large non-white turnout, that favors the president. And so the goal is to drive turnout down and to make the electorate as white as possible. And that's what Republicans are trying to accomplish with these laws.
Well, just in closing, my understanding is that the Texas law that the Attorney General has put on hold, and you just said that the appeals court in Washington may uphold the Texas law. I'd like to get some details on that if I could, but one of the most outrageous things about the Texas law is that you can use your gun license as a form of ID to vote, but student IDs don't pass muster.
That's true. That is true. And in Texas, they found that nearly 600,000 to 800,000 registered voters don't have the ID, and they're disproportionately Hispanic. And not only that, but in Texas, only 81 of 254 counties actually has a DMV office where you can try to get the free ID. In those counties where there is no DMV office, Hispanics are twice as likely to not have the ID. Not only that, but to obtain the free ID, you need to pay for underlying documents, including a birth certificate, which costs $22. So that is the equivalent of a poll tax. Now, in terms of how the process works, under Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, states that are covered by the Voting Rights Act, which are 16 different states, either all of the states or part of the states, they have to seek clearance from either the Justice Department or a D.C. district court for any changes that impact minority voters, and they're not allowed to make changes to election law that diminish the ability of minority voters to participate in the political process or to elect candidates of their choice. So what the Justice Department action does is it blocks the laws until the D.C. District Court has made a ruling, and it also means that the Attorney General's office will testify against the state of Texas at that trial, and that the D.C. District Court, it's a three-judge panel, is likely to take DOJ's findings into significant consideration. But as I mentioned, it is possible that the court could break with the Department of Justice on this issue.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, Ari Berman.
Thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Ari Berman, who's a contributing writer to The Nation magazine and an investigative journalism fellow at The Nation Institute. He has written extensively about American politics, foreign policy, and the intersection of money and politics. He is the author of Herding Donkeys, The Fight to Rebuild the Democratic Party and Reshape American Politics.
We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about British Prime Minister's visit to the White House with British humorist Martin Lewis.
By murdering the plants, ignoring all the history, denying them romance. The pinstripe men of morning are coming for to dance. $40 million, the kids don't stand a chance.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Martin Lewis, who is a US-based English humorist, writer, radio and TV host, producer. He's known for his work in a variety of projects, including co-creating and co-producing, along with John Cleese, The Secret Policeman's Ball, benefit shows for Amnesty International. He appears regularly on television and writes prolifically for The Huffington Post and other publications. Welcome to Background Briefing, Martin Lewis.
Hello, good to be back with you.
And today, or tonight, as we speak, there's a state dinner for the British Prime Minister David Cameron. There's been a meeting all day at the White House. Yesterday, they caught a NCAA basketball game, President Obama and Prime Minister Cameron. I take it, though, that Cameron's more of a cricket man, right?
I think he's more of a cricket man, and the English are ever adaptable, especially when it comes to people who they need to borrow money from. So I'm sure he sat through the basketball game and ate the hot dog with a big smile on his face.
And obviously, whenever the British Prime Minister and the American President get together, they pretend they're Churchill and Roosevelt, right?
Well, I suppose so, but without the blanket. I mean, the thing about this special relationship, as it was so called, is that it's a marriage of great convenience for both parties. I mean, let's face it, the United States of America, which I'm delighted to live in, is basically a like Britain, but just not quite so classy. So on the other hand, the British, we the British, wearing my original homeland hat, are like the Americans, but we haven't got any money, or rather we've got even less money than you. So, and we don't have an empire anymore. So it's a question of a kind of old uncle without any money and a young nephew with not much money either.
So what do we have in common? Rupert Murdoch?
Yes, we both detest Rupert Murdoch. I think that's the only thing is that the British are very pleased that he took U.S. citizenship. However, I'm very curious about something. When he took U.S. citizenship in 1986, I think, he presumably had to go through a very rigorous set of hearings. I'd like to think that in the light of all the information that's come to come up in the last year, including the fact that officials at his corporation in the UK were bribing policemen bribing officials, that's actually against the law here in the United States. And perhaps if he made representations in his immigration hearings where he was taking U.S. citizenship that conflict with that kind of moral turpitude, perhaps that could be re-examined. I don't know.
Well, it seems like all those around Rupert Murdoch are heading for the hills or being arrested or being basically fired in the case of James Murdoch, his son. He told MPs in this inquiry in Britain that he accepted responsibility for not uncovering wrongdoing earlier. He is, of course, a victim of the famous Fawn Neville email in which it suggested that James Murdoch knew about these wrongdoings, and they went far beyond the single reporter in the memo, Neville Thirlbeck, who was rearrested today.
Indeed. Well, first of all, and this does not apply just to James Murdoch, this is just a general point about our present-day society. There is a world of difference between people issuing a press release or a statement saying, I accept full responsibility for something, and actually accepting full responsibility. I think a lot of people seem to think that it's rather like an apology. If you say it, then you've done it. But what is the exact definition of accepting full responsibility? Simply saying it doesn't seem to be it. Now, James Murdoch is out as the head of News Corp at the moment, only because the U.S. News Corp don't wish to be tarred with that rather unpleasant brush. But he's still at the moment the head of Murdoch's satellite TV operations in the UK. But he'll be jettisoned if he seems to be interfering with that too.
Well, I was amused, Martin Lewis, again. Martin Lewis is the US-based English humorist, writer, radio and TV host. And we're doing an update on all news that is British with the British Prime Minister visiting the White House today. But what's going on back in England seems awful, a lot more interesting. I was amused to learn, Martin, that the Metropolitan Police rearrested Neville Thirlbeck, arrested him by appointment. Now, that sounds very genteel.
Well, he must have been a member of an old boys' club. He may have gone to the right school, have the right school tie. The whole thing about the English, we are very genteel. You know, we don't go in for these low-speed chases in a white Bronco. If it's a white-collar crime, we basically say, look, would you mind terribly? We think you've done something a little bit on the naughty side. If you wouldn't mind popping down for a cup of tea and a bun, perhaps around 4 o'clock, if that would suit you, that would be terribly nice. So that does tend to go on a little bit.
Well, what I find extraordinary, though, is that Rebecca Brooks, who was clearly Murdoch's protege in News Corp, she's been arrested along with her husband, Charlie. Their next-door neighbour, I understand, is none other than the British Prime Minister, David Cameron.
Yes, they're all part of a rather tony set in that part of England. It's kind of rather like the Hamptons. It's the British equivalent of the Hamptons, where sort of fancy New Yorkers go to mingle amongst with each other. And the Chipping Norton set, as they're called, Chipping Norton set, they go hunting together and so on. And in fact, so cozy were the relationships were between Rebecca Brooks, who at the time was the editor of the News of the World newspaper, Murdoch's Sunday tabloid, and the British Metropolitan Police, we think of that as Scotland Yard, that they were so cozy together that they were giving her police horses that were no longer fit for service. They were just giving them to her to look after. David Cameron reputedly rode on one of these horses. You're basically talking about a close relationship. I'm trying to think of, this would be like a cozy relationship between the editor of the New York Post and, say, the head of the FBI, where you think there needs to be some proper distance, or somebody, the head of the Justice Department, the Attorney General. You need to have a little bit of distance. Otherwise, how are you going to clear, fair operations of things that involve the police and the newspapers? So there was David Cameron was such a friend of these people that he was visiting them, riding on horses loaned to this editor of the newspaper by the police, who that newspaper was bribing to give them secret information to write news stories to make money. It's a very unsavory business. And frankly, David Cameron is very happy to be away from England when all these arrests are happening.
Well, she was arrested, Rebecca Brooks was among six people arrested by what's called Operation Weeting, officers of Operation Weeting, a new task force that they formed on suspicion of conspiring to pervert the course of justice. But it looks as though the Metropolitan Police and Scotland Yard were on Murdoch's payroll.
They were on the payroll, and in fact, this is a very belated investigation because they did investigations, I believe, in around 03, 04. They did an investigation in 06, another investigation in 08. And on each occasion, the Metropolitan Police, after very thorough investigations, some of which lasted more than 45 minutes, after about 45 minutes of investigation, said, oh, there's not enough evidence here, and would drop the cases. And this went on until the Guardian newspaper, which is a British paper that I think you can see online here in the United States, they investigated and found so much evidence that they caused all of this to be brought to attention. And now, belatedly, Scotland Yard is investigating. But part of when you have a thing, a crime called a conspiracy to pervert the course of justice, this is basically the equivalent of what happened to Richard Nixon in Watergate. This is basically interfering with the justice system. Perverting the course of justice means that you're trying to destroy evidence. And apparently, and I'm sure this was just an accident, but apparently something like 10 million emails of the last few years all accidentally got wiped out one day. I don't know why this happened, but apparently 10 million emails of the News of the World and the Murdoch Corporation all got wiped out, and for some inconvenient reason they now can't give them to the investigators. It's very puzzling how that would happen.
And of course, the investigators, Martin Lewis, again, US-based English humorist, writer, radio and TV host and producer, the investigative body of the British Parliament is the Commons Culture, Media and Sports Committee.
Well, that's because it's always considered good sport to try and prosecute politicians and newspaper people. So they do that. One of the leading, you might remember, there was a testimony given by Rupert Murdoch and his son, and somebody actually threw a custard pie or foam pie in the face of Rupert Murdoch during those hearings. The grilling, and it was such a gentle grilling compared to the kind of work that happens in a congressional committee. Rupert Murdoch, actually, a lot of people felt came out of it quite well because he was able to put on this image of being a rather doddering old man that couldn't really remember things, which is not really consistent with what people say about Rupert Murdoch, that he's extremely sharp, even at his age, sharp as a tack. But that was one of the main questioners was a lady called an MP called Louise Mensch, who happens to be married to the manager of Metallica. So there's just it's wonderful to watch this pop cultural convergence where you're seeing the manager of Metallica cross-examining Rupert Murdoch with softball questions. I found it quite endearing.
And she's a mensch, right?
Well, she's married to a mensch. Peter Mensch, who is the co-manager of Metallica, is a mensch, a delightful fellow. I don't have quite so much experience of his wife, who is a Conservative MP, extremely attractive. That she the questions that she lobbed to Murdoch were pandering and softball, to say the least.
Well, I recall that incident where the pie was thrown in his face, and his wife, the Chinese lady, who I think they've effectively estranged, leapt, you know, like crouching tiger to defend him.
Oh, she did. Wendy Deng, whose right. name, incidentally, in China, and I checked this from a very authoritative Chinese source, my local Chinese restaurant, her name is actually pronounced Deng. And I thought that was, rather strange that a woman married to Rupert Murdoch, whose first name in the first part of his second name, Merde, in French, also is the same name as his wife's name in Chinese. Merde and Deng. Interestingly about her, I mean, one thing about her is amazing. She has to be given credit for this. A lot of people encountering I think he was about 70 years old at the time, would have looked at this withering old man and just been repulsed by him. But apparently it was sort of financial lust at first sight. I mean, she just found him completely irresistible, and one can't really be sure why.
Well, Martin Lewis again, US-based English humorous writer, radio and TV host and producer. He's produced a variety of projects, including co-creating and co-producing, along with John Cleese, the Secret Policeman's Ball benefit shows for Amnesty International. And you made the point, and I think it's it looks incredibly fortuitous that Prime Minister Cameron left town to meet with President Obama at the time of this flurry of arrests of his next-door neighbour and all of his friends and the kingmaker in British politics, Rupert Murdoch.
Well, yes, but I'm more concerned, actually, about the White House dinner tonight, because it's not really a state dinner, because, he may be in a state, but he's not actually the head of state. That is Her Majesty the Queen that's the head of state. He's the head of government.
By the way, that's a point that was there had to be... Sarah Palin had to be instructed on that. Did you see the movie?
I Game Change. Did. In fairness to Sarah Palin, she was still having to be instructed about who we were fighting World War II against, so she can't really be expected to understand complicated things like who the head of state of Britain is. That's not fair on Sarah Palin. She can only see Russia from her house. She can't actually see Great Britain. But the reason I'm worried about the state dinner tonight is this. David Cameron, when he was a younger man, attended Oxford University, and rather the equivalent of the clubs that George W. Bush and John Kerry were a member of at Harvard, Yale, those sort of Skull and Bone Society. David Cameron belonged to a society called the Bullingdon Club, and they were very basically rich kids who dressed up in very distinctive and very distinguished-looking outfits that made them look like cast-offs from Duran Duran or Spandau Ballet. But they would go round... The main thing that the Bullingdon Club members would do is they would go round Oxford Town, which is a really beautiful, beautiful old English town. They would go into restaurants, maybe about 20 or 30 of them, order everything on the meal, on the menu, have this fantastic feast, unlimited champagne, and then destroy the restaurant. I mean, literally smash everything to pieces. They were rather like The Who on the Smothers Brothers show. They would just smash the furniture. But this wasn't wanton destruction, of course. They would then pay for the destruction. They would just be so wealthy, they would literally open up their creaking wallets and throw large amounts of cash on the floor to cover the cost of destruction. And this was this passed for amusement among young conservative gentlemen of David Cameron's class. This was what they did in the early 80s. I'm only worried that if he has some kind of flashback to that behavior, it is quite conceivable that he may just simply, having a rather large wallet with him, he may just decide to trash the White House tonight and then offer to pay for the damage.
Well, as long as he can borrow the money from the Americans.
Well, that's exactly it. Who in turn, of course, will borrow them from the Chinese, which is where we came in with Wendy Deng. So really, what the world comes down to now is we're all looking to Murdoch's Wendy Deng to bail us all out.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Martin Lewis.
My great pleasure. Love to do it with you.
Again, I've been speaking with Martin Lewis, who is a US-based English humorist, writer, radio and TV host and producer. He's known for his work on a variety of projects, including co-creating and co-producing, along with John Cleese, the Secret Policeman's Ball benefit shows for Amnesty International. And he appears regularly on TV and writes prolifically for The Huffington Post and other publications. Again, I'd like to invite you all to join me for the UCLA Hammer Forum I'm hosting on getting rid of super PACs, which are overwhelming our already money-driven political election system. Lawrence Lessig, a professor at Harvard, is joining us. He's written a book called Republic Lost. Again, tomorrow night at 7 p.m., free and open to the public at the UCLA Hammer Forum in Westwood. Join me. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Chris Scheid. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing.
Bye for now.